This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Mary Wilson, a founding member of the Supremes, which had a string of hits in the 1960s and helped define the Motown sound, died Monday at her home in Henderson, Nevada. She was 76. The band that became the Supremes actually began in 1959, when Wilson was a teenager living across the street from Diana Ross. The pair teamed up with Florence Ballard to form the Primettes and eventually began hanging around Motown Studio after school, hoping for an audition. They were eventually signed and changed their name to the Supremes in 1962. With Diana Ross as lead singer, the group had a dozen number one singles in the 1960s, including Stop in the Name of Love, Baby Love, Back in My Arms Again, and Where Did Our Love Go?
Baby, baby.
Diana Ross left the group in 1970. The Supremes replaced her as lead singer with Gene Terrell, and they had a few more hits before breaking up in 1977. Mary Wilson then had a solo career, recording two albums and performing into the 2000s. Over the years, she had some conflicts with Motown Records and with Diana Ross, who tweeted Tuesday that she had wonderful memories of her time with Wilson. Terry spoke with Mary Wilson in 1986 when she'd written a memoir called Dream Girl, My Life as a Supreme.
What kind of material did they initially give you at Motown?
They didn't know what to give us. I mean, that was one thing because, you see, we, as the world soon found out, we were the kind of singers that were not soulful. I mean, we were black, but we didn't sing R&B. Which is our voices. I mean, you can look at Diane's voice today. It's just not an R&B voice. And even though Florence was sort of a soulful singer, it was very hard to put us in a category. And our songs were very, I'd say, bubblegum-type songs, you know, not as soulful as Martha and the Vandellas or the Marvelettes.
So they didn't know what to give you?
No, they had no idea which way to go with us. And in fact, we had 11 records. Now, that's 11 discs, but with two sides, so that's 22 records. So you see, we had recorded quite a bit before our first number one record, trying to find that sound for us.
I want to play one of the early records that mm-hmm. I think is before you really found that sound and before Holland Dozier and Holland were writing and producing.
Okay, now I want to bring this up too.
Yeah.
Now, before we found the sound that the public liked, I think still the sound, the recordings that we did earlier were very, very good and, you know, songs that they still were us, but the public didn't like them.
Well, let's hear Let Me Go the Right Way. This was recorded in 1962. That was, what, a year after you'd signed your contract?
I guess. We signed in 61.
So tell us about this session.
Okay, now this was a happy session. This was a song that was very, to me, was a good record, and I felt it should have been a hit. It had Diane singing the lead, and in those days she had a very, very high voice and a nasal, I'm yours, you know, real nasally sound. Well, you'll hear it when you play it. Let Me Go the Right Way.
Oh my.
That's the Supremes, as they sounded in 1962, Let Me Go the Right Way. You were still really kids when you recorded that. When you signed your first contract, it was 1961, you were under 20, right?
Well, we were 16. We had not reached 17 yet.
When did Berry Gordy, the head of Motown, make the Supremes his focus of attention? You really became his girls.
Well, I must say, I'd have to answer this question my way, if you don't mind, for a second, okay? Because the reason that I wrote the book is to dispel the rumor that Berry Gordy made us his girls, and that Berry Gordy made us into these chic, you know, nice plastic dolls. In actuality, the three of us, every single minute, were pestering them for this, for that. We would beg the producers to produce us. I mean, it was our persistence that really, as you say, made Berry make us his girls. But I don't think, had we not been that persistent, he would not have. But he saw in us something that, you know, he felt he could really, here's a group that I don't have to tell them everything. I mean, they themselves are businesslike, you know, they are here on time. They, you know, they would look at the clothes they wear. Part of our image was what maybe was responsible for that becoming so very prominent in Motown, because they said, well, now these girls have class. Now let's maybe pattern some of the other people. So I think what I'm trying to say is that we sort of made Berry pay attention to us. But thank God he had a good eye, you know.
When the Supremes started performing together, you'd alternate leads. You sang the lead on most of the ballads.
Yes.
But it wasn't too long after your recording for Motown that Diana Ross started singing all the leads. Whose idea was that?
Okay, that was Berry's. Berry said to us, and as you heard, Let Me Go the Right Way, they allowed us to, you know, sing whatever. But after a while, Berry said, you know, I really think that Diane has a more commercial voice. And by this time, we're in with Motown, and we respect his opinion. And we said, well, if we really want to hit record, you know, what the heck? He could have chosen any one of us, and any one of us could have done the job. We were all for it. However, I don't think Florence nor I knew or could even imagine that he meant we would never be able to sing again. And it really broke down to that. So it wasn't Diane who said, you know, she wanted to do all the leads. It's just that he felt her voice was more commercial.
Was it frustrating for you to have your singing part confined to oohs and ahs and baby babies?
Well, in the beginning, it wasn't. Because I always felt that I would be able to sing. I mean, it just didn't dawn on me that early that it meant never will you sing. And when we're becoming very, very popular, I got to the point where I would just go to a producer and say behind everyone's back, listen, I want to sing one of the songs on the albums. And they'd say, well, you know, Diane is the lead. I say, yeah, but I mean, this is a ballad. This is the kind of song I can sing, you know. And then I approached Berry one day, you know, when I was really frustrated. And I said, Berry, you know, I want to sing a song. And he says, oh, you can't sing. And he just kind of brushed it off. And so it did bother me. But I also want, while I'm saying these things, that this was not the major thing that was going on with me at the time or with the group. Because these were things that we kept under wrapped, and they were personal. Like if you're married and you love someone, but things kind of go on day to day, but you're not happy with it, but you still love the person. So I want people to know that, yes, these things were going on, but I was having a ball. Let's face it, we were like princesses, blaps, black American princesses, you know, and it was a beautiful thing. It was really beautiful. So if we can kind of add that beauty in there along with this, I'd feel very, very good about that.
How did you change your image from wearing mini skirts to the sequin gowns and white gloves?
Oh, yeah. That was, I think, the little gloves and the short skirts and the cute thing came from us still being teenagers and not recognizing that we were growing up. But the minute we started hanging around Motown and around the guys, I mean, when you have people like Marvin Gaye, the Temptations, even the Four Tops, walking around there, and they're handsome, and we were like really young, and in awe of all these men. So immediately we wanted to be these grown-up girls. That's when our dresses changed, and we started wearing the longer gowns. And it was really just to be grown up.
When you were touring on the first Motown tour, there was a chaperone for the girls,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Did they lecture you before the tour?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, it was amazing because now you're talking about the Marvelettes, who were four country girls. I mean, they really were country girls. Very sweet. Very sweet. But just, kind of a little slow. Then you have Martha and the Vandellas, Mary Wells, and Claudette of the Miracles, who was older, and she didn't necessarily need a chaperone, and then the Supremes. So all these young kids on the same tour, young females on the same tour with all these men, Motown was really, sort of frightened that something might happen, and they had every right to be. So they, especially with me liking Eddie Kendricks, I mean, because I loved that man. I still do. I think he is the sweetest. He has this boyish look about him that just makes my heart just... Ugh. Anyway, so they hired friends of theirs. Barry's mom was called Mom's Gordy, and everyone loved her. So she had many, many friends, and she'd always bring in her friends to give them jobs, and they would become chaperones. And the chaperones would always say to us, "Now, girls, we're going out on this tour, and I don't want to catch anybody out of their room after 8 o'clock." And we said, "Yes, ma'am," And they were very nice, but I think a little overly protective. But they had to be, because if anybody did get in trouble, they would, it would be like they had lost their little self-image there. So they were really nice to us. But we had chaperones up until we were almost 25 years old.
Charlie Atkins did the choreography for most of the Motown groups. How did you work with him to get the movements for your songs? What were those sessions like?
Hard. I mean, I'm saying real hard. To learn how to do choreography it looks easy when you see it on stage, but to go through every movement, Charlie had us working where if we had one song, "Where Did Our Love Go?" We said, "Where did our love go?" And brought our hands all the way around the head, all the way down, made a complete circle. So Charlie would spend a whole day on that movement to get us to move it exactly the same speed, the same, the same angle. It was, for me, always very easy choreography. I danced very easily. Florence was a bit awkward and she would become very upset with herself because she was awkward. And Charlie was the kind of guy who is very hard, but he's a sweetheart. And so his whole approach would be, "Florence, now I want you to get this step. You have messed it up 3 times and bump." And sometimes she'd go in tears. Now, Diane is the kind of person that will work very hard on something. If she realizes she can't get it, she will study it every second. Just sit there and really just concentrate. And I've learned mine. I'm over in the corner just sitting down, cooling it. So the whole key now is that people remember the choreography just as much as they remember the song. So that makes me know that it was all worth it.
Was it his idea for you to hold up your hands when you're doing
the
stop?
The stop, yes. The stop, yeah. That's the famous one.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the records some more. You had mentioned earlier that when you joined Motown that they really didn't know what kind of material to give you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And after a few years of recording different people's songs, you were basically given to Holland Dozier and Holland,
right,
who wrote and produced your material. What was the difference between what they were doing with you and what had been done before?
Terry, I don't know. That has been something that I've wondered about. It was like we were meant to be with them. It was like finding the perfect tailor. The minute we worked with them, it was just like magic. In fact, they saved us. The entire company was calling us the No Hit Supremes, and HDH brought us out of that. And we were able to laugh at all the other groups at Motown, for calling us the No Hit Supremes.
They wrote almost all of your hits, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did they change the kind of backup singing that you were doing?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. No one has ever really put it like that, and that is a point, because even though we gained our great records and our great sound with HDH, we also lost sort of the group thing. You know, I mean, what was ours before we came to Motown, and that they gave, I always said that the sound they gave us was really more Diane's sound, and we were her backup. And that was kind of sad in a way, you know, that in gaining our sound, we also lost a part of our uniqueness. So I'm glad you brought that up.
When they gave the group a sound that you associated more with Diana Ross, mm-hmm. than with what you'd been doing, did she heartily approve of that? Did she like fronting the group in the way,
yeah,
that she was?
Yeah, you know, she really did. And I cannot say I blame her. I finally realized today that what Diane was doing was not so much being self-centered, is that she felt that it couldn't be done right unless she did it. I think that's a better way of saying, rather than saying she was self-centered and very aggressive. That's really what I want to bring out.
How did the group become Diana Ross and the Supremes, mm-hmm. instead of just the Supremes?
Right. Through just with Diane becoming more and more popular. And, of course, at the time, people started saying that she was a spokesman, and all of the attention was on her. So it just eventually led to that.
Well, when you look back on it, the Supremes had such a strange history. Diana Ross became one of the biggest superstars in America.
Yes, definitely.
Flo Ballard died at a very young age, not too long after she left the Supremes.
Mm-hmm.
And most of your performances are in Europe.
Right. So it's like, right, it's like, oh, poof. This is true. I made that decision to go to Europe and to travel around the world because I knew that if I stay here with the Supremes as such, we'd become an oldie but goodie. Now, around the world, they'd never really seen us as much. So I could travel and receive nice amounts of money and things like that. Plus, I could regain my confidence as a singer, which I did. Now,
how had you lost it?
By singing only oohs, by not growing. It's as if I stopped growing at the age of 16 because I never sang anymore. It's like my confidence now is really good. I know I can sing because I do it every day. But on the same hand, because I did that, I lost my American public. So now I must come back and record and let them know that, hey, I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down. Do you love me? Do you love me? Oh, Terry, I got you a smile. I'm so happy.
What do you think about when you hear the old Supremes records?
I just start listening to them, really listening to them.
Well, you couldn't listen to them before?
It was like I was too much a part of it. I was too much a part of it. And maybe, I can't say I didn't appreciate it, but we did them every day. I mean, I've been singing Baby Love and Stop for about 20-some years, you know, so it's something you just don't do. But now that I had to write the book, in doing that, I also had to listen to the records. And in listening to them, I found that the sound is really beautiful. I have no regret singing only the background because I feel that, you know, the public loved all of us. No matter what the publicity said, the public still loved all of us. The book signing today in Philadelphia was beautiful. I mean, I felt like, I can't even tell you how much happiness I received. People would come in and say, well, Mary, we love you, you know, and keep up the good work. And thank you for showing us Flo, you know, that side of Flo. We really appreciate that. So I'm just feeling really, really great about the whole thing.
Good. I'm glad.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Mary Wilson of the Supremes speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. Wilson died Monday. She was 76.